Hello and welcome to the history of Bangalore. I am your host, Ramji Chandran, and in this episode, we will discuss the historical importance of Begur. Today, Begur is a suburb of Bangalore, but it predates Bangalore by centuries, and its history is of considerable importance to modern-day Bangalore, yet little is known either about Begur's history or its significance. Begur lives in a warp. Tales of its glorious past are compelling but fleeting wisps of history. There is a heartwarming story I found in the pages of Dr. S.K. Aruni's book, Bengaluru Parampare or Bangalore Heritage, and in a chapter about Begur is the legend of Ammanamma, a tale of resistance and spirituality that challenged societal norms of the day and was a beacon for women's rights. While some parts of the story indeed seem like folklore, the story itself and the consequences described in the story are quite real. I have been fortunate to have discussed the story with its author and learned several nuances of the tale that did not make it to the published version. Dr. Aruni will join me later in this episode to talk about the historical importance of Begur, but first, I will tell you the story of Ammanamma. Before that, allow me to thank the Prestige Group, with whose support this podcast becomes possible. Building cities, one landmark at a time, they transform dreams into reality. You can be a part of the future. Simply add prestige to your life. And now, the tale of Ammanamma. The story begins in a Brahmin family living in the Begur Agrahara. Agraharas are places where Brahmin communities live. Central to the story is a young girl named Amrita. She was known as much for her intellect as her beauty, and no less, her deep inclination towards spirituality, unusual for her age. Amrita was not only literate but well-read. This in itself was not unusual. A young Brahmin girl like Amrita would have been literate and would have received more than a rudimentary education, but not a more formal education, as the role of woman in the community was to maintain domestic purity and assist the husband in rituals. So a traditional Vedic education was deemed unnecessary for them because they did not perform rituals. Even so, Amrita, like others in her community, would have gained considerable knowledge informally from simply hanging around in an environment of education and knowledge. Her ability to delve into texts that many of her playmates would not even have begun to fathom was remarkable, and this ability clearly manifested itself in her growing and vast knowledge of matters spiritual and philosophical. As time passed and she became older, Amrita's father, true to the customs of the time, arranged for her to be married to a young man from Begur who was studying in the Veda Pathashala, the school for Vedas that young Brahmin boys went through. Amrita did not want to be married. She'd tried to explain that she could not be married because she was, she said, a goddess and could not marry anyone because she was married to God. No one listened to her, and there was little she could do, and the wedding went ahead. On a night that is supposed to mark new beginnings for young couples, her husband approached her, intending to consummate their marriage. But rather than intimacy, he came face to face with a profound spiritual fire within her that he found both intimidating and unsettling, and he backed away in fear. Now, at no point in the retelling of the story has there been any notion that she had merely rejected his intimacy and his advances. That it went deeper has never been in question. The young couple at some point must have discussed their relationship and their future, and Amrita persuaded her husband to go to Kashi to further his studies. She said this might make him worthy of her respect. Kashi, modern-day Banaras or Varanasi, is one of the seven sacred cities in Hinduism and is considered a particularly auspicious place to study and gain knowledge. So the young man set out on foot, walking to Kashi in the old Brahminic tradition. Tragically though, he never returned to Begur. he died in Kashi, or at any rate, sometime after he left Begur. When news of his premature death reached the family, it resulted in a turn of events that brought unpleasant consequences upon Amrita. For one thing, her parents, bound by tradition, decided that Amrita must now live as a widow. Old Hindu tradition is not kind to widows. A widow is considered a bad omen. They were made to shave their heads and wear drab clothes and behave like the living dead. This was not something Amrita could accept, and she refused to follow any of the customs that branded widows, and she simply went about her days quite normally. This rubbed against the grain of the entire Brahmin community of Begur, and they did their best to force her to accept her traditional fate, but Amrita resisted. The volume of complaint from the intractable Brahmin community eventually reached the ears of the authorities at the Sringeri Mutt, and they decided to interfere. Even the Jagatguru, the Mutt head, decided to personally visit Begur to try and persuade Amrita not to go against the wishes of the community. But as the legend is told, in their private meeting, something happened, and the Jagatguru backed down and backed away. He left the room saying there is nothing he could or would do about her, and left without explanation and not a little shaken. Among other things, apparently the seer received a lecture from the young Amrita about how the Brahmin community must rid themselves of their old practices and work towards the liberation of women. The community continued their rant. Faced with social ostracism, Amrita's parents decided that they could no longer live in Begur, and they relocated to Mysore. But Amrita chose to stay. For the rest of her life, she devoted herself to the people of Begur. Over time, she became a beacon of mysticism and miracle, and was revered for her acts of healing and comforting the troubled. The people of Begur loved her back and lovingly called her Amanamma. Despite the wonderful difference she was making to the lives of so many people, the Brahmin community kept up their pressure on her and subjected her to humiliation, rejection, and scorn. Finally, Amanamma had had enough, and she decided to take Jiva Samadhi. In the traditions, the act of taking Samadhi is when someone consciously leaves their body. It is not to be confused with suicide, which is the consequence of a troubled mind. Great sages are said to have exited their mortal selves whilst sitting cross-legged in a deep state of meditation, or placing themselves in a situation deprived of basic sustenance, allowing life to ebb away from their body. And Samadhi, it is said, is in the realm of the divine. Amanamma's method of taking Samadhi was to bury herself alive. But as she did so, she placed a curse upon the Brahmins who had persecuted her, and she decreed that they will never find the peace of a homestead in Begur. The curse reverberated through the Agrahara, and it led to the eventual departure of all the Brahmins from Begur, and to this day, not one Brahmin family is known to live in Begur. Years later, a local leader called Patela Krishnappa said that Amanamma came to him in a vivid dream, and by her dictates, he commissioned an idol of her, and then he built a shrine to her at the spot where Amanamma had left her body. And this has since become a place of reverence. The tale of Amanamma was set in a time when the rest of India was waking up to social reform. It wasn't too long ago. It was in the early 1800s, around the time of Raja Ram Mohan Roy, and it was a time when a few brave women stood up to the injustices of society. While the Brahmins of Begur had clung to their old traditions, the people of Begur had no trouble accepting the widow Amrita as independent, free-spirited, and indeed went on to worship her. This is a testament to the forward-thinking spirit of Begur, a spirit that has been seen from the 8th century onwards in matters like modern methods of administration and engineering techniques that could be considered wonderful for its time. But it's a pity that Begur's heritage stands in ruins. The walls of the fort are falling away, and there's little left of it. Foliage has crept over the ruins. But really, it's the chaotic urban growth that is the greater ugliness. Yet, in the middle of this, in Begur, the locals have not forgotten Amman Amma, and she is worshipped every full moon day. And the Brahmins of Begur have never returned. Begur is a most interesting town, but also a most underrated town. Its own existence goes all the way back to a prehistoric time. Archaeologists have unearthed artifacts in Begur from the Neolithic period, that is, from 2000 to 1000 BC. There's evidence of a thriving human domesticity, shards of pottery being one example. And in the early medieval period, beginning with the rise of the Western Ganga dynasty in the 4th century AD, Begur started to show the promise of becoming something of an administrative and cultural center. And then in the medieval and later periods, that's from the 10th to the 20th centuries AD, Begur's strategic importance really solidified. And then it started to wane following the establishment of the modern city of Bangalore in the 16th century. Begur lay at the crossroads of important trade routes. It was a center for learning, it was a center for religion and philosophy, and it served as an important hub for successive dynasties, including the Cholas, the Hoysalas, and the Vijayanagara emperors, and later, made all the more important because of its strategic location smack in the middle of the Deccan Plateau. But today, it is a forgotten island of heritage in the zone of one of the most congested and chaotic traffic junctions in Bangalore. And an uncaring administration has protected neither its lands nor its heritage. And a little further south, by large lumps of buildings, in the electronic city, home to many leaders of what is called, ironically, the knowledge industry, a knowledge that clearly doesn't begin at home. Look up Begur on Google Maps. Notice that right around the Begur area are a significant number of blue patches on the map. These are lakes and tanks caused by natural depressions in the topography. The Hoysalas call these bodies of water sandras. So neighborhoods that are suffixed with the word sandra means they are or were bodies of water in low-lying areas. Examples would be Bommanasandra or Singasandra. There are many others. The existence of these sandras was no accident. These tanks were planned and engineered and funded by different dynasties that ruled the region, by the Western Gangas and by their successors. Because Bangalore was not near a major source of water like a river, the ancients used the natural features of the land to catch and store rainwater. And then using their skills in engineering, they created a system. Tanks to capture and store the water, sluice gates to control how much water was let out of the tank, and then canals for irrigation and domestic use, and also to connect up the different tanks so one tank could catch the overflow from another and thereby keep a balance among them and not waste any water. These are lessons in water management and urban planning that we appear to have all but forgotten. And if you stop to think about it, I'm talking about forgetting lessons from the 8th century while we sit here in the 21st century. Even back in the 8th century, they knew the difference between wetlands, which is low-lying areas used to store and move water and cultivate crops, rice for instance, and higher areas or dry semi-arid lands used for living, raising cattle and farming. And even if we no longer rely on lakes and tanks for our water supply, draining them and blocking off the water pathways was not such a good idea. And if you wonder why more and more neighborhoods in Bangalore get flooded every monsoon, this is why. By the way, don't miss our upcoming episodes where we will dive into how, in early history, they used the land and what we grew on them. Back to our story. Begur was a great example of such advanced water management techniques, gate and canal engineering, and an important area under cultivation. One thing inspires another, and Begur became an important town, and in later years, a strategic source of supply for the needs of the military, logistics and such. With its growth, it needed to be defended, and a fort with military encampments came up. And not the least, Begur became a player in the shifting power of dynasties through the growth of religions. And this merits some getting into. Begur is a temple town, but unlike today, temple complexes were not merely destinations for pilgrims. They were the most important social centers of their time. Temples were repositories of information and of record keeping. They housed granaries of scale, where a strategic reserve of stored grain could be used to feed people in times of pestilence or drought. And then temples also had, usually attached to them, chaul trees or multipurpose buildings. Other than being community centers serving as venues for weddings or community events and religious ceremonies, these chaul trees were places where travelers and pilgrims came to rest, sleep, and escape the elements during journeys. They were much like the travelers' inns. There was food and water available, and typically veterinary services at hand to tend to horses and bullocks that accompanied the travelers and the traders. Building temples and chaul trees near temples was seen as an honorable, charitable act. And so they were often funded by donations from kings, nobles, and rich merchants. And such donations were always acknowledged on stone inscriptions. And of these, there are hundreds. Begur's Nageshwara temple complex thrives to this day, but only as a place for worship, but still attracts thousands of worshippers and visitors. But in its time, that very complex was important for all the reasons that I described before. The region has been home to religion even in earlier times. In Begur, around the temple complex, are some testaments to a very strong Jain presence, even if, sadly, they are in the form of fallen idols. A headless Tirthankara, one of Parshvanatha, and others discarded in nearby ditches or thrown to one side to make room for building new roads or lanes and such. But in connecting these abandoned Jain objects with the temples of the Nageshwara complex is a tale of how politics and religions have always been bedfellows in history. And here again we encounter the all-important local Begur chieftain of the 9th century, Nagatara. One of the inscriptions found at the Begur temple by former Commissioner Bowring is a hero stone commemorating the Battle of Tumbepadi, where Nagatara was killed. This battle is said to have taken place sometime around 900 AD. The battle was triggered by the Gangavadi king Eriyappa, who ordered Nagatara to join forces with Ayyappa Deva to fight his arch nemesis, the Nolamba king Veeramahendra. In this battle, Nagatara fought well, but he was killed. The Gangas won the battle, and Nagatara's son was rewarded with the chieftainship. In his book, Gangas of Talakad, historian M.V. Krishnarao suggests that the Nolambas were getting too territorial, a little too big for their boots, often acting in violation of accepted norms and treaties. He writes that Nolamba king Veeramahendra's sinister designs on dominion and his policy of territorial aggrandizement were sufficient causa belli for a war against him. Causa belli is Latin for justification for war. There are a lot of theories about why Eriyappa and Veeramahendra were always at war. But one prevailing theory is that the underlying cause for most battles over territory is religion. The connections between religion and political power are many and deep. Often, religion draws its power from political patronage. So when a religion or faith declines, it usually means an associated decline in political clout because of a shrinking following among the people and finally, an erosion of military power. So right through world history, religions that have seen themselves in decline or under attack have often asserted themselves through offensive action to keep the faith and the following. And the same can be said in reverse when aggressive expansions of territory can cause the popularity of the religion of the new rulers. And in this story, lies the decline of Jainism and the growth of Shaivism. According to Dr. S.K. Aruni, the death of Nagatara was a significant point in leading to this. Evidence of that is how, soon afterwards, Shaiva settlements and temples came up in Bangalore, including the famous Someshwara temple in Ulsoor, and even more of those as the Cholas stamped out the Western Gangas. On inscriptions in the Nageshwara temple complex and evidence of Jain bastis lying scattered across the old town is the microcosm of all this history, etched on the crumbling walls of Begur. And now to continue our conversation from the last episode is historian S.K. Aruni. Right after this.
Prestige Group brings to you its latest launch, Prestige Somerville. Lake-facing 3 and 4 bed apartments on Marathahalli, Whitefield Road. For more details, call 85489-85489. Project is RERA approved.
Always a pleasure and a privilege to have you back on the show, Dr. Aruni. So tell me, you've been listening to my narrative. In your eyes, was what the Gangas achieved in the 8th century with all that water management in Begur, was it significant?
Thank you for inviting me again. It's a very interesting episode on Begur. So altogether, if you look at the 10th century history of the Begur, one could easily understand how Begur played a very important role in the Bangalore region. My answer is to your question that the water management. Till the 8th, 9th century, the irrigation system was introduced. Of course, we have the oldest inscriptions of the Kadamba in Chandravalli. It talks about the construction of the tank. But the construction of the tank is one part, but how to manage the water is another part of it. This management was very interesting, which we get inscriptions of the Begur area.
Clearly, they mastered it. You've said that Begur was strategically located. Now, one is, it was on trade routes, wasn't it? But the other, you say something about it being a gateway town.
Yeah, you are right, sir. That is certainly you mentioned that it was situated on the trade route. It's a kind of a junction. From there, one can easily go to the Banagattar side, Suryamukhi river side, right. And also you can go to the Anekal side. So they can cross the river Kaveri and go to the southern part of it.
Right.
So those who come from the Kaveri, the first thing is that they will have to see this area. Begur was the major township on that area.
In your book, you had made the case that when the Nada Prabhus took over and started to build Bangalore, the importance of Begur started to wane.
Yeah.
It started
right.
to diminish.
Diminish, yes, sir.
You wrote in your book that Begur was a very important logistical supply center during the Anglo-Mysore Wars.
Yeah, you are right, sir.
So while Begur declined in importance, it remained strategically important to supply a war effort. So was that of significance or wasn't it?
Surrounding Bangalore area, there are many places like, you know, Begur. Mm-hmm. They actually supported the Bangalore for various reasons, sir. Supported in the sense, Begur happens to be the one of the rich, fertile area, surrounding area.
Right.
Large agricultural activity used to be take place, and also commercial activities used to take place. And since the both agriculture and commercial activities are very prominent in this Begur area, present Begur village consists large number of what you call commercial communities, shettis and others.
Right.
These communities and also agriculturists, they played vital role in the most of the history of Bangalore, particularly during the wars.
Right.
Any kind of wars, you know, these were the big suppliers to the you know, localites.
Right.
So that's why the British were very keen in the coming to attack Bangalore. They came through Anekal, Vasoor and Anekal through. So Begur was one of the very important place for them to stop the grains and supply of the food items to Bangalore. So we have a very good map which mentions about the places where the British were controlling before the taking war place.
Right.
So this is what we could trace the history of that.
Right. And you have covered so much of this in that wonderful book you wrote, Bangalore Parampare.
Yes, this Bangalore.
And
yes.
Here is my personal copy.
Thank you, sir.
Could you talk to me now about what I was saying earlier about the influence of religion being a major cause of political unrest, even war?
Yes, ancient history of Bangalore region, including Begur, very interesting because, you know, there is a conflict of two different religion and communities, which could be seen in the inscriptions as well as the memorial stones. Best example is the Begur hero stone.
Right.
I take it as a very important, you know, historical significant for the battle. In this battle, we could see Nagatara and his family belong to the Jains.
Mm.
It is a, you know, we have the evidence of Nagatara's daughter-in-law. And others also, they were, you know, Jains. It is referred to in the inscriptions also. Western Gangas were patrons of the Jains.
Right.
The other counterpart, Nolambas, were the, you know, patrons of the Shaivites.
Right.
So after these conflicts, continuous conflicts, you know, Western Gangas loses the power slowly. And Nolambas became a very prominent in this area.
Right.
With that, you know, Shaivism becomes the very important religion and rapidly spread over this area. Like Kolar to Bangalore, you could see number of temples, of Shaiva temples built after the 10th century.
Right.
So Jainism slowly declined, and also I think from 10th to beginning of the 14th century, no Jaina temples were activities we could see in the inscriptions.
Mm-hmm.
Shaiva as well as the Vaishnava, you know, due to the Ramanuja's entry into this Karnataka through this Bangalore area, you know, like a Domlur, Vaishnava cult took the another second phase of the after the Shaiva. So slowly Shaiva and Vaishnava, but Vaishnava becomes very prominent after 15th century. We could see in the Ranganatha temples, Venganatha temples. So this shows that, you know, after the 13th, 14th century, Vaishnava as well as the Shaiva actually took over from the Jainism.
And there are many historical accounts about the unease and conflicts between these two communities as well, some of them pretty bloody. So it goes back to the nexus between politics and religion and war. Am I right?
Yes, you're right, sir. You're right, sir. I agree with that.
And finally, to your efforts in trying to find something of prehistoric importance in Begur. Any luck with that effort?
So I tried to trace that area, but I could not because of large, you know, extended urban activities. So it was very difficult for me to trace the ancient remains there.
Nothing at all?
Yeah, that they have already vanished because of buildings, apartments. They dug up most of the area, so we can't even trace where it was.
So no official move to preserve its heritage?
No, sir. Only temples are the standing monuments of this village. So because even the fort, the present fort is also almost invisible because of various large activities of apartments building. So we have no control over the controlling of the heritage. Heritage is only remained in the papers, that's all.
Our heritage is only on paper. What a trenchant comment. Well, at least Begur gave us a clue about the name of our city.
Yes. That is true, sir. That is the only pride moment for us, sir.
Yeah, isn't it now? Well, this is fascinating, Dr. Aruni. Thank you so much for being here. I'll try to get you back as often as possible.
Thank you, so nice. I'm very glad to be part of this, sir.
I'm honored that you should say that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
It's hard to imagine that you can drive only 15 minutes from the Silk Road Junction and travel back over 1,000 years in time. Much of its heritage is gone, but there are still some living memories in Begur. Don't miss our next episode coming right up, the battles for Bangalore, the battle for Ebbal, and the battle of Thumbepardi. I am Ramji Chandran, and this is The History of Bangalore.